you guys doing another movie review today. Going a little bit obscure with this one, maybe. I feel like, I don't know, this is one of those movies that it kind of made a big splash, at least in the sort of art house festival circuit when it first came out, and then it kind of disappeared for many years. It does seem like in the last few years it's kind of getting a critical reassessment. I think it only just recently got released on Blu-ray. It had like disappeared for many years. There was only like a crappy VHS. And it's crazy. This is kind of like one of those quintessential cult films. And I feel like a lot of people have not seen it. It's not for everybody. I'm not gonna say that. I guess no movie is, like I said. But if you want to watch it at the moment, at least as of this recording, it's actually on Tubi in the United States. You can watch it for free. This is the 1990 very weird film, The Reflecting Skin. Now, is this a horror film? Sort of. It's sort of a horror art house sort of hybrid movie. It really gives me a David Lynch kind of vibe. A lot of people have compared it to Tideland by Terry Gilliam, maybe some of Terrence Malick's earlier films, something like that. It is very, I've seen it called Prairie Gothic, which, yeah, I guess that's pretty accurate as well. But yeah, this is a weird ass film. And it's also notable. Not only for being a weird ass film, but also for being one of the very first starring roles for a young Viggo Mortensen, who shows up in the movie about halfway through. So, what the hell is this movie about? Let's delve into this, shall we? If you guys have not seen this, I am going to spoil it. So, if you haven't seen it, you might want to go to Tubi or whatever streaming service you can find it on and watch it. If you're into surrealism, if you're into art house horror, if you're into just like really creepy, weird, like David Lynchian kind of shit, it does have kind of a Blue Velvet kind of thing, except more of a rural America thing rather than a suburban. But if that sounds like something that you can jive with, then go watch it and then come back. But like I said, I'm going to spoil pretty much everything that happens in it and kind of discuss what maybe the symbolism is, because there are a couple different interpretations of this film, and I'm not really sure which one of them I kind of adhere to, but we'll kind of talk about that maybe in the comments or whatever. So as I said, this movie was actually directed by Philip Ridley, who's a British director. I believe this was his first feature-length film. He's actually something of a Renaissance man. He's actually a visual artist. That's, I believe, how he got his start. He's also a musician. He's also does a shit ton of stuff in theater. You know, so he's just kind of like multi-talented all around, and he has made a handful of films over the years. As I said, The Reflecting Skin being, I believe, his first feature-length film. The cinematographer on this, which I feel the need to mention because the cinematography in this movie is breathtaking, was Dick Pope, who probably best known for all of the films that he shot with Mike Leigh. He actually did almost all of his films, as far as I've could tell from his Wikipedia page. This doesn't look anything like a Mike Leigh film, but I just thought that I would you know, point that out. He won a lot of awards for this particular film. Now, as I said, when this movie came out in 1990, it was sort of the belle of the ball. I believe it was, you know, it won all these awards at Cannes and all these like European film festivals. Everybody's saying it was a masterpiece. I actually saw it. I'm not really sure what attracted me to it. I think it's nominally, I want to say it's nominally a vampire movie, but not really, which I'll get to in a little bit. I think I saw the VHS copy in, if I'm remembering correctly, in the video store near where I grew up. And I must have seen it in 1991 because I remember writing about it. And I remember writing about it in an apartment I used to live in Daytona Beach behind Bel-Air Plaza, the old Bel-Air Plaza across from the Atlantic Ocean, across from A1A. And I moved out of there in late 1991. So it must have been 1991 that I saw it. I think what I did, for whatever reason, I rented it and I watched it and I really, really dug it because I thought it was like really strange. And so I made a dupe copy of it with my, because I used to have one of those fancy like dual deck VCRs like back in the early 90s. So I made a copy of it. So I watched it many times over the years. And then I always kind of remembered some things about it. Particularly the opening scene, If you've seen it, you will know what I'm talking about. It makes a large impression. So I remembered that, and I remembered a little bit kind of what the story was, but not exactly. So it was really neat, like, to watch it again, because I haven't seen it for probably 20 years at this point, maybe even longer, and I had forgotten a lot of stuff about it. So it was kind of cool to revisit it. So this story is actually set in a very rural small town in, I believe it's supposed to be Idaho, even though the film was actually set in Canada. I think it's sometime in the 50s, like sometime 1955, somewhere around there. The main character is an 8 or 9 year old boy named Seth Dove. Now, the family that he lives in, kind of fucked up. We'll say that. It's kind of like his mom is very, what's the word that I want to use? She's kind of a lunatic. And she's also very abusive. His dad is kind of checked out. You find out some things about him later on, which I'll get into in a bit. But he just doesn't seem all that involved in the family life and his son's life. He's just kind of keeps to himself and kind of, reads his novels and just wants to check out of everything, which in a way you can kind of understand. I will say that the first scene, now, like I said, if you are very, very sensitive to animal cruelty, you will probably, the first 5 minutes of this movie, you'll probably just turn it off. You'll be like, yeah, no, I'm not gonna, which is kind of the impression that it made. It's fake, don't worry about it, but I will say in the very first few minutes of this movie, Seth and two of his terrible little friends, who are also little boys, their names are Eben and Kim, and they have a thing where he finds this enormous, he calls it a frog, but it looks like a cane toad. I mean, it's really, really big. It's a big frog. And they proceed to put a little pipe, like, or a straw, like, up its butthole, and they inflate it. And then they lay it in the middle of the road so that when this woman who's kind of also lives in the town, she's kind of the town recluse or whatever, when she walks by in the road, there's this big inflated frog laying there, and the kids shoot a slingshot at it, and the frog explodes all over the woman. So just say that's what you're getting in for. This is like literally the first 2 or 3 minutes of the movie. So these children are kind of horrible. Now, I will say too that I don't really think that there is a likable character in this entire movie. Everyone, like I said, it's very Lynchy, and everyone is just very, there's everyone has just these strange mannerisms and strange personality quirks. Everyone's kind of terrible. I don't know. They're like compelling nevertheless. Probably Viggo Mortensen's character, whose name is Cameron. He's Seth's older brother. And like I said, he doesn't come into the movie until about halfway through. He's probably the most sympathetic character, but he's got a lot of problems as well. The widow that the frog gets blown up all over, her name is Dolphin Blue. She is also quite sympathetic too, but she's kind of a nutcase. So even the sympathetic characters are kind of loons. You know what I mean? So this is just, it's a very, very strange movie. Okay, so, so you have these boys that blow this frog up. And so she gets frog blood all over her. And Seth's crazy mom makes him go over to Dolphin Blue's house to apologize for blowing the frog up. And as he does that, him and Dolphin Blue get into this very, very strange conversation. Now, she is a widow. Her husband hanged himself about a week after their funeral. I'm not sure how long it's been since that happened. But she's still in mourning. She still wears black everywhere, and she's got like sunglasses and everything. So she's very striking, like walking through these like bright yellow wheat fields, these big vast fields, of which I believe the director Philip Ridley, the legend goes that he would come to the scene, this he would come to the set like every morning and spray paint the wheat fields so they'd be yellower. So it would look, I don't know if that's true or not, because it's a lot of wheat fields. I mean, if you see the movie, I don't know if anybody could spray paint all of that. But that's the story anyway, because they are very like vibrant yellow. So she has lost her husband, and she is still very, very broken up about it. So this whole conversation between her and the little boy, she's basically saying things like, well, she was like, well, I didn't so much care about you blowing up the frog. I just didn't like that you got blood all over my dress. And then she tells him weird shit like, oh, have you ever tied firecrackers to a cat's tail? It's awesome. You should do that. So she's a weird, weird lady. And then she starts talking about her late husband in this very strange way. And she has this little box that has all of these kind of mementos of him. There's like a, you know, a little bottle of the cologne he used to wear. One of his teeth is in there, like, so like a thing of his hair and all this other kind of stuff. And so it's just like this really weird situation. And the kid says something about like asking how old she was, or she asked him how old that that he thought she was. And he said, oh, I'm 50. And she said, oh, I'm 200 years old. Now, obviously, if you're an adult, you know she was just kidding, like in a weird way. But the point of this movie is that everything is seen through Seth's eyes. So everything in this movie that happens, you're not really sure if it really happened the way that it's portrayed, or if you're only seeing it that way because Seth saw it that way as a little boy, because he didn't understand what was going on. He didn't understand the adult world. He didn't understand the various horrors, you know, that happen over the course of the movie. So he was interpreting things in a way that would be sort of fantastical to an adult. So let me just get that out of the way right there. So because of all the weird shit that she says, and because a little bit later on, one of his little friends, Eben, turns up murdered in the water cistern in town, he starts to suspect that Dolphin Blue is a vampire. Now, he gets this idea because his dad was reading a book about vampires and the kid was asking about them. And even the cover on the front of the novel looks pretty much like a wheat field with a woman with a black outfit and black sunglasses and stuff, looking very much like Dolphin Blue. And it's like about, it's called Vampire Blood or something like that. And it's, she's kind of like beckoning to a kid. So again, it seems like on the nose, but remember that you're seeing things through his eyes or how he's remembering them perhaps. Because I've seen some people say that this whole movie might be him as an adult remembering back to this particular summer in 1955 and filtering everything through that lens where he didn't really understand anything that was going on. So he becomes convinced that Dolphin Blue is a vampire and is starting to kill all his little friends. Now, when Eben turns up dead, the first person that the sheriff suspects is actually Seth's dad. And the reason that he has for suspecting him is, one, that Eben was found on their property, like on their farm, in their water cistern. And also because at some point in the past, Seth's dad was caught kissing a 17-year-old boy. I'm not sure how long ago this was. I don't know if he was much older than 17 or something like that. But like I said, this is the 50s and it's a very, very rural area. So anything that smacks of, you know, not being straight is going to be like, hey, you must be a murderer. So, you know. So at this point, because the dad gets blamed for the murder and everybody in town kind of thinks that he's the one that did it, he kills himself by drinking gasoline out of the tank at his gas station, because that's what his family does. They run a gas station, and then pouring gasoline all over himself and lighting a match. So it's self-immolation. So he basically blows up the whole gas station, and Seth sees the whole thing happen. So he sees his dad blow himself up, like in front of his face. So as I said, you're having all these horrific things happen where, you know, first he talks to Dolphin Blue about, you know, the suicide of her husband. And she's kind of talking about that and talking about grief and telling him about evil and things like that. Then one of his friends turns up dead. Then his dad blows himself up. His mom, like I said, is also very abusive. She does things like, you know, like one time he leaves the light on like a little bit too late and she like smacks him around and makes him keep drinking water, but not pee. She's basically waterboarding him, shit like that. She's just like a lunatic. So it's just this crazy fucking shit. So after his dad dies, his brother, Cameron, who's played by Viggo Mortensen, comes home from the army to kind of take care of the family because the mom has just like completely checked out and now she's like a complete nut, you know, so, and you know, there's no dad. So Seth needs somebody to look after him. So Cam comes home. Now Cam has been, I guess he's been in the Pacific and he participated in some of the like atomic bomb tests and things like that. So he's kind of fucked up too because he's seen some super fucked up shit. So he's not really the same either when he comes back. Everyone in this movie is like a broken person in some way. So even though Seth is kind of like looking up to his brother and hoping that now there'll be some restoration of normalcy, obviously that is not going to happen because, like I said, Cam is kind of fucked up. He's normal sometimes, but then, you know, the whole title, The Reflecting Skin, kind of comes from one scene where Cam is showing Seth like some pictures that he took over there. And there was this one picture of a baby. I don't know if it was alive or dead, but it had some kind of radiation sickness, and its face, he said it was, the face was like reflecting like a mirror and you could see yourself in it. And so they're kind of using that as a symbol. Not only, you know, the baby had reflective skin, but also vampires maybe could have reflective skin. Vampires can't be seen in mirrors. And then there's also the thing of Seth reflecting the world through his sort of broken innocence, I guess, because this is kind of the summer where he went from a child who didn't understand anything, and then all these horrific things happened, and it sort of invaded his childhood and made him grow up really quickly. But he sees everything through, I guess, a mirror reflection of his naivete, I guess, is one way of putting it. I forgot to mention earlier that a few times during the movie, there has been like all these kind of greaser looking dudes, and they're driving around town in this black Cadillac. And they seem a little bit menacing, you know what I mean? So that's another thing that's going on in the background that you have to, you know, take into account. So after Cameron comes back, him and Seth are visiting Seth's dad's grave, their dad's grave, and Dolphin is there as well. And Dolphin Blue and Cam kind of start taking a hankering to each other. You know, they kind of fall in love. Now, Seth, of course, is horrified by this because he believes that Dolphin Blue is a vampire and that she is going to drain his life force. This is reinforced because, as I mentioned earlier, because Cam had been involved in all of these atomic bomb tests in the Pacific, he has radiation sickness. So a little bit, he doesn't look too bad, but his hair is falling out. His gums are bleeding. He's losing weight. So, of course, Seth doesn't know that he has radiation sickness. So he interprets this as Dolphin Blue is draining your life force. So basically, this kid is seeing everything that he doesn't understand and casting it in a supernatural kind of light. You know what I mean? I think kind of the theme of the movie, and I was watching a video earlier where he was kind of breaking down the philosophy behind this. And he's like, basically, there's during this first conversation that Dolphin Blue and Seth have, she says something to the effect of sometimes evil happens quite naturally or something like that, which I think is almost kind of like the movie's mission statement, because I think the movie is kind of showing that if you're a child or someone that's very superstitious, you always want to attribute these horrific things that happen, evil things that happen, to something outside of us, something outside of humans. So something supernatural. But the movie is showing that it doesn't need to be supernatural. Humans do horrible things all on their own. So we have to like move past this childlike, you know, vision of the world where everything has to be caused by an outside force, you know, because humans are terrible enough on their own, which, you know, that's a cheerful message, isn't it? But so because he believes that Dolphin Blue is a vampire, and because he believes that she is the one responsible for killing his friend Eben, who I neglected to mention, this is so weird. This movie, it's like if you describe what happens in it, people like think you're fucking high or you're making it up. But seriously, this does happen in the movie. At some point, Seth and his friend Kim, they find in a barn, I'm not really sure how it got there, but it's sort of like this ossified fetus. It's like a dead baby, but it's like, it's not mummified. It's almost kind of like, I don't know. It's like really weird. And they find it. And for some reason, Seth starts to believe that this dead baby is Eben, like in a incarnated angel form. So he takes the dead baby home, keeps that under his bed, and like talks to it at night as though it's his friend Eben. Okay, so I forgot to mention that. There's all kind of weird details in this shit. I haven't even mentioned like the two twins like talking like birds or anything. It's just like there's so much bizarre shit in this, and it's like hard to, you know, keep track of it all. So the thing about it is that even so, he believes that Dolphin Blue is killing, you know, has killed his friends, is draining his brother's life force. But then the weird thing is that he sees with his own two eyes the aforementioned greasers in the black Cadillac kidnapping his other friend, Kim, who later turns up dead. Now, there is some speculation, because I don't believe anyone else in the movie ever sees the black Cadillac or ever interacts with the dudes in the black Cadillac except for Dolphin Blue. So some people have speculated that the greasers in the black Cadillac are actually not there, that they're actually a manifestation of Seth's imagination, and that, in fact, Seth killed his friends and is kind of casting back, you know, allaying guilt for his crimes by saying that it was like someone else that did it. It was this gang. But yeah, so they kidnap Kim, put him in the car, and then later on he turns up dead as well. Now, at this point, as I said, he has this huge argument with Cam because he's telling her, look, Dolphin Blue, she's a vampire. She's draining your life force. That's why all these bad things are happening to you. That's why you're losing weight and your hair's falling out and all this other kind of stuff. And he, of course, just laughs at it. He's like, look, you know, I'm in love with her. She's in love with me. We're running away together. We need to get the fuck out of this place. And so he is kind of, you know, fails in trying to save his brother. But then, like, right at the end, Seth sees her. And she is wearing white now, meaning that she has moved past the grief over her husband. She's done mourning and she's ready to move on with her new life with Cam. And she comes toward him and she says a few things about growing old. And, you know, she's like, when you get older, you know, this will happen to you. You'll get arthritis and you'll shit yourself and, you know, all your teeth will fall out and all these other things. She's like, but so she has this long litany of like all these horrible things that happen to you, like while you're aging. But then at the end, she says, but if you find somebody to love you, then it's OK. Then you'll always be young. So she kind of says something like that. And then she says to him that she's going into town and she needs a ride. At which point, the greasers in the black Cadillac drive by and she gets in the car with them. Now, even though Seth has seen these dudes, whether they're real or not, has seen these dudes kidnap his friend who later turned up dead, he does not warn her that they are murderers. So she gets in the car, all smiles, and then later on she is found dead laying in the cornfield. At which point, Cameron, of course, has a nervous breakdown. And the very, very last scene of the film is Seth finally realizing that she is not a vampire, that none of the stuff that has happened, none of the horrific events that have taken place have been attributable to a supernatural force, that it was a human force. So it's almost like he kind of grows up all in this one day and he just runs out into the cornfield. It's sunset and he just screams and screams and screams at the sunset. And then he has like all this dirt falling. Which goes back to something that his dad was saying about, you know, you need to drink something or you'll be dust or whatever. And like I said, that kind of goes back to the vampire thing too, because, you know, vampires turn into dust in the sun. But basically it's him coming to terms with humans can be evil, that's all that evil is. It's just horrible things that humans do to one another. You don't need a supernatural aspect. And the fact that he did not warn Dolphin Blue, or in some interpretations that he maybe killed Dolphin Blue and just, as I said, maybe those dudes aren't real and maybe Seth was the one doing all the murders. But he's kind of just come to realize that his brother's life is destroyed now. You know, everything, like every horrible thing from the adult world has come crashing in on his childhood innocence. So as I said, this movie, it's very, very strange. It's kind of like one of the quintessential cult films. And I think it's one that was kind of a little bit forgotten about. I don't think, like I said, I think it came out, it made a big splash when it came out, as I said, on the festival circuit, but then it sort of went away and like nobody really talked about it for a really long time. And then I guess on the internet, some people started talking about it, especially because of that, you know, exploding frog thing in the front, because that was certainly the scene that made the biggest impression on me, you know, and I still remembered it after all that time. And so I feel like it kind of got a little bit rediscovered and it got, you know, because for a long time it was only on VHS. And then there was kind of like, I think there was a Japanese DVD or Blu-ray or something, but it was kind of crappy quality. I think 2015, I think they finally released it on Blu-ray, although I believe it's limited edition. But yeah, I mean, this is a gorgeous looking movie. The director, Philip Ridley, has said that he, you know, even though he's British, he had, you know, seen a lot of American films, obviously, and had read a lot of American literature and wanted the film to look like kind of an American Gothic, like, you know, the paintings of Andrew Wyeth or Edward Hopper, something like that. This actually kind of reminds me a little bit. It has a little bit of the same vibe as The Other from 1972, you know, by Thomas Tryon, which, you know, we did a retrospective on a while back, but in the sense that it's just this very, very rural setting and just like this golden color palette with, you know, all of this, you know, this almost kind of like idyllic, gorgeous looking surface and all of this, you know, sort of rot going on underneath it. So, you know, that's very much the theme of the whole thing. Like I said, more that humans are the cause of evil instead of like supernatural. Now, as I said, I don't know. This, it's very, very art house. It's kind of slow moving, I guess, but it just has so many weird scenes and just so many like disturbing images. Like a lot of fucked up stuff happens in this. And I've even watched like some reviews of it by younger reviewers that were like, man, that was fucked up. There's like fucked up stuff happens in this. So I'm just saying that if you're into more like traditional horror, I guess you probably won't be into it. You might just think it's weird or boring or something like that. But it's just really, it's a hard to describe film if you haven't seen it. But yeah, it's on Tubi at the moment. As I said, I think there's a special edition Blu-ray that came out in 2015, although I think it was limited edition, so I don't know if there's any of those left or not. But I definitely would recommend it, especially if you're into just real, you know, kind of if you're into like if you like stories like, you know, Flannery O'Connor or something like that, or you liked David Lynch, like some of David Lynch's movies, you would probably really dig this. It's super, super weird. Not a horror movie necessarily, but it's kind of like a weird, arty. I don't even know if I'd call it a drama because that makes it sound too pedestrian, I suppose. It's just a very weird, surreal. You know, it's very Terry Gilliam, very it's just along that line. So if you like stuff like that and you haven't seen it, then I would definitely recommend checking it out because I feel like it's still a little bit under the radar. A lot of people don't really talk that much about it. But yeah, it's on Tubi at the moment if you want to check it out. So that'll do it for this Flickers of Fear, and I will see you on the next one. Bye.